Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Serving spiritual seekers around the world. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Fort Worth in Texas. And I'm hoping you can all hear me because I'm hearing a lot of distortion here, but maybe that's just at my end. Today it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the irrepressible Peter Boland. He's a singer-songwriter, professor, blogger, and writer. And it's always a joy to discuss spiritual principles and their application with him. Today's topic is based on my current article in Unity Magazine entitled Staying Awake. The feature write-up says that it is a Unity minister delving into a giant No, I've got it completely wrong. See, I knew I'm being thrown off here. Hold on, let me go to the actual magazine. A Unity minister delivers, there we go, it's my handwriting is so bad, delivers a giant jolt of contemplative caffeine, which is what I need right now, obviously. So let's hope that our show gives you that pickup and inspiration too. So I welcome Peter Boland to today's show. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks a lot for having me. What a important subject this is.
Well, it is important, isn't it? All joking aside, you know, it's difficult to stay awake. And we might say, well, what do you mean by that? You know, I'm awake. I live my life. I get up in the morning and do my things. But we're talking about a different kind of awakening, aren't we? Awakening to a greater potential of who we are. It's often called enlightenment, whatever that is. But it's varying degrees of being aware of what is happening for us and around us, and more importantly, within us. But, you know, easy to fall asleep, easy to be in a trance, isn't it, or in a conditioned system of thinking and being. You know, we could spend our whole lives in that trance. And unfortunately, it seems that society and the media, whatever, sometimes encourages us to be good little consumers, you know, not to think too much about things, just buy, and enjoy at that level of being. And by so doing, we sort of dumb ourselves down.
Well, perhaps awakening is bad for business. I don't know. But you know, it's fascinating, isn't it, that throughout history and in all cultures, lovers of wisdom, you know, philosophers, have toyed with various metaphors for this very important insight about the nature of human consciousness, that somehow, through no fault of our own, I suppose it's just the nature of the equipment we've been given, the processing equipment, we do fall into these trance states, these collective dreams, these unconsciousnesses. And whether it's Plato's allegory of the cave or, you know, these days it's mostly Buddha's metaphor that everybody uses, the idea that normal life, the way it is normally lived, is a kind of sleep. And the unexamined life is a trance state. And so that whole terminology of waking up or awakening is obviously a metaphor drawn from our literal sleep-wake cycles every day. But it suggests something important about consciousness, that the unexamined consciousness, the unexamined life, is not fully connected or present to what is. And this, of course, generates all kinds of suffering individually and collectively. So it's a problem.
Yeah, you know, Jesus didn't use the metaphor of awakening so much, but he was definitely aware of the difference between being in a trance or a conditioned state and being fully present, you know, because his emphasis was on what we do with our ears and what we do with our eyes. And he encouraged us to, you know, he who has ears, let him hear. And obviously, he's not talking literally. We all have ears. But he's talking about those inner awarenesses, inner hearing. You know, what are you really listening to? Listen completely from a different perspective rather than from what you thought you understood or what you were supposed to understand. And the same, you know, he invited us to watch, you know, watch and pray. Look clearly. And I think looking and hearing, you know, from that spiritual perspective, you know, are two essential elements in waking up. So Jesus was, you know, exactly right, wasn't he, in terms of, you know, we put our senses to sleep, basically, because we don't see as we did maybe when we were a child, you know, where everything is kind of undifferentiated, you know, everything's possible, and then it slowly becomes, well, no, look at this, name things, and you know, we talked about in a previous show, once you name things, you no longer see them. You know, you've got a nose. Before it was, oh, this mysterious object at the end of my face. You know, now we've named it. We don't have to look at it anymore. It's I've got a name for it, and I put it away. And of course, that's the thing that Adam was, you know, given the gift of naming things, and it's the beginning of our forgetfulness in a way.
You know, that's so true that Jesus and Paul too in the New Testament used the imagery of a vision of the eyes, you know, plucking the beam out of your own eye, or Paul's seeing through a glass darkly. So the idea of perception is the metaphorical realm of choice of these early Christian voices, but it is exactly the same thing, because they're talking about, of course, consciousness and not literally visual perception. But what the mind, how the mind shapes the uncarved whole and the names that it gives to things, that's the architecture of the intellect that, in a sense, encases us. And what Zen Buddhists call returning to your original self is that process that Buddha calls awakening, coming back into our original primary relationship and coming out of our judgments and struggles. And so in this unity piece, you really point out very, very powerfully the problem and then offer these really great seven simple practices to increase this shift. And it's a really great article.
Thank you, Peter. You know, the thing that strikes me the most is that, you know, yesterday's doorway or yesterday's awakening moment, you know, can be today's closure. There can be a difficulty for us, and that sounds counterintuitive or contradictory, but I think it's so true. I was watching a show, a documentary about Steve Jobs, you know, the founder of Apple. It's just come out, a very fascinating insight into his character. And it says at the end, you know, he created a beautiful garden because he was very into Zen himself and went to Japan many times and had a Zen master, Koban Shino, and he created a beautiful Zen garden. And if you look at the products, you go to an Apple store, you'll appreciate it Zen, like, you know, simplicity and the quality of his machines, you know, the iPhone or whatnot. But he created a beautiful garden that we couldn't leave, he had it all worked out. You had to enjoy the garden on his terms. And I thought that was interesting. He was a man of great vision, but without much empathy, is what the documentary narrator said. And I thought, what a tragedy that is. You know, he pushed the limits in so many ways and yet created a sort of a strange world where, although the iPhone brings us together more, it also isolates us more. So it comes with a seed of its own destruction. And there's a wonderful scene in, you know, where Koban Shino talks about Steve Jobs coming to him at age 18, I think he was, and said, to Copencino, I'm enlightened. And Copencino says, wonderful, but I need proof. And he brought back, the next week, he brought back a computer chip or whatever, the silicon chip. And Copencino said, well, I wasn't sure if that was proof of his enlightenment, but he was always asking me to make him a monk. And he said, I don't think he was ready for that. He was a brilliant man, but he was too wise. No proof. And I thought, wow, what a testimony for, you know, because I admire Copencino as a very down-to-earth master, you know, but you know, we can get lost in our brilliance sometimes. You know, we think we're awake. We think we're free. We think we're enlightened. But it's sort of, I think Ram Dass called it the golden chain. We're still chained to our ego, but we think we're enlightened. And that's a tough place to be.
You know, this is such a great point. I, as I teach philosophy and religion, both in the academic settings and outside, and write the things that I write, I'm often asked that, what is awakening, and do teachers of awakening, which I don't count myself as, I'm not some guru going around doing that kind of thing. I'm just a student like everybody else, but there's always this maybe unspoken, maybe uncomfortable question. Once teachers start talking about the awakening process, you kind of want to know in the audience, is this guy awake? What does awakening look like? You know, when we think of our favorite teachers, Adyashanti or Ramana Maharshi or whoever, Deepak Chopra, Wayne Dyer, you know, do they have some prize that we do not yet have? And that question really has to be deconstructed. I think that's the role of the teacher, to start to frame awakening as a possession or as an achievement. That's part of the structure of consciousness that has to be, I think, torn apart. Awakening is not an achievement. It's not a special magical state. And that's why I love the Zen approach, that it is characterized there as absolutely ordinary. And as you point out in the piece, your natural state, that you don't have to develop your inner witness. It is there already full. And it just is to be allowed. It just is to be, once the noise quiets down of the busy mind, it simply begins to shine through a little bit more directly. And so it's tricky. Our language traps us in this idea, well, if I'm talking about awakening and I'm not awake, then I have to go somewhere other than here to get there.
Right. And like you said, it's all about me, me, me. You know, I'm enlightened, which is an inbuilt sort of contradiction as well, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like, well, you can't say that. You know, the minute you say I'm enlightened, you're probably not, because your ego is still attached to it. So it's much more natural and, as you say, ordinary than that. You know, I was over at my daughter's and her husband's home last weekend, and to see my granddaughter as well. And we were just sitting on the sofa chatting, and it was twilight. I look across the street, and it's an ordinary suburban street, and there were two lights shining on the house. One was a bright light, one was more dim, and there was a tree above the brick wall, and it was typical suburbia. But I looked over there through the windows of their house, and I thought, this is perfection. This is divine order. And it just flooded my being, you know, that all is well. Everything is beautiful. And, you know, you could say, well, that is a totally ordinary scene. There's nothing remarkable about it whatsoever. And yet for that several moments, you know, for me, that was the perfect place to be. And I thought, my goodness, that's true. Everywhere you go, everything is perfect, it's beautiful. And, you know, that is, to me, you know, what we might call an awake state. It's awake to everything that's happening, you know, without quantifying it or judging it, but just to be present to it, because it there is a magnificence even in a corner or a suburban place. So that's profound for me. And, you know, it's not something you can teach to another. Oh, look over there. You know, you'll find enlightenment if you look at that building. No, it's only going to work for – they'll think you're nuts. It's only going to work for me. But you find your own, you know, moment of breakthrough. And it doesn't come, you know, when we expect it, I don't think. It doesn't come when we go to the most beautiful place or the most gorgeous temple, or we find the most perfect teacher. You know, those are – those could be errors. running and chasing after things like that.
Yeah, now I'm going to be driving around suburbia the rest of the day looking at homes, trying to catch that. No, you know what? You say it best in your piece. These miraculous moments are visceral, not intellectual. And that's key to me. It's not a concept that then you can then explain to somebody else. It's visceral, meaning it's physical. It's something that is embodied. And yes, what you saw through the eyes was a trigger or a catalyst, but the awakening didn't come through the eyes or from the lights on that house or the tree or anything. It simply shined up through your original self. And so the Upanishads make this claim that, you know, when you look at a sunset or a beautiful mountains, that's a way of seeing oneness, or a perfect twilight in suburbia. That's a way of experiencing oneness. But the oneness does not come from the environment. It comes up out of your embodiment, which is what we all are all the time anyway. And for some reason, we get quiet enough once in a while, or a sign of beauty rattles us out of our self-centeredness, and the ego falls away, and then all that's left is this bliss. It's beautiful, but of course you want to hold it, grasp it, name it, carry it into the rest of your day, and that's when it gets tricky.
Well, and it has to begin with us. You know, there's a great quote from Cobencino again, referring back to him, where he says, you know, if all the masters of this world, if all the enlightened beings were gone, you know, where would you find enlightenment? And somebody says, everywhere. And he says, no, within yourself. And I thought, yeah, great point. Because, you know, once you find it within yourself, then you see it everywhere. But if you don't, it's not the other way around. You know, it's always within ourselves. And then, sure, you can. It'll pop up everywhere. It'll pop up on a suburban street. It'll pop up in a, you know, in Yosemite or whatever. And there are certain places probably where, you know, it is more palpable, because there's awe-inspiring places, there's awe-inspiring paintings and music and whatnot that can bring us to that state more readily, perhaps, than a pile of dust. But it, inherently, it's within everything, including that pile of dust.
This is the challenge in all of our spiritual work. Are we trying to become something else? All of this talk of transformation and transcendence and so on sometimes is misleading and gives the unintended message that who you are right now is wrong. And when we drop all of that, then we will move into this true self. And so it has to constantly be reinforced. And you said it great again in your piece. The key is not so much transforming ourselves from asleep to awake as it is remembering our true nature. So in Plato's Republic, he calls, or in several of his dialogues, he talks about learning as recollection. That's really what wisdom learning is. It's not getting new information. It's just remembering who you are. And
yes,
that's the recollection piece. So being still, letting things be, deciding to enjoy, all of those things that you discuss in the piece are exactly the right techniques for quieting down enough for that simple realization to arise.
But in the irony is that many of us have thrown out that idea of kingdom of heaven later, you know, which is a more traditional Christian viewpoint. You know, wait, it may be a veil of tears now, but you're going to get your reward after you die. We've thrown that out, but then we've also taken on board, well, I'm not good enough right now, but one day I'll be enlightened. You know, but it's the same idea. It's always the good is arriving tomorrow or later, you know, never today. And again, Jesus, totally contradicted that, didn't he? I'm using the word contradict a lot. That's interesting. I wonder why it's coming up. But he said, no, listen, you know, the kingdom is not coming with observation. It's not coming later. The kingdom of heaven is already within you. I hear the music, which means
sounds like we're going to have to wait.
I'm with Peter Boland. He's going to wait. I'm going to wait. You don't have to wait. You can listen to these messages from Unity and join us when we come back, and I invite you to stop struggling, okay? Stop struggling!
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727
from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching, spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
Spirit of Recovery is the place where spirituality and recovery meet, where we support your spiritual growth. Reverend Anna Schaus, Ph.D., interviews down-to-earth guests who share with you how they keep going and growing in recovery. Spirit of Recovery is the place to get practical tips and join in lively discussions on topics that matter to recovering people. This program welcomes everyone who wants to know more about recovery. Join Anna and her guests live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Central Time on Spirit of Recovery, where we talk about what keeps you growing. Only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. One of the interesting things about my website is that we've got a lot of podcasts on there from the church. So if you want to listen to some of my sermons, feel free to pull up pauljohnroach.com, and you can hear what we're like on Sunday mornings as well. I invited you to stop struggling. You know, one of the things that prevents us from relaxing into clear seeing and awakening is this idea of struggle. And I share a famous Zen story about a young man who comes to the master asking to become enlightened, and how long will it take? And the master says 7 years. And he says, well, what happens if I work really, really hard and then double my effort? And he says, 14 years. In other words, you know, the more struggle and intensity that we put into it, we can push it further away from ourselves. It's that old pushing the river metaphor, if you like. But it's a tough one, isn't it, Peter, to balance the two? You know, you've got to have commitment and energy and determination and perseverance. But you've also got to have the light touch and, you know, be relaxed about it. And I guess that's true in any sport, too. You know, it's a great sports person is able to have, you know, intense power and energy, but also complete relaxation at the same time.
Exactly. You know, the Bhagavad Gita is a good place to start here. Krishna says there is action in the midst of inaction and inaction in the midst of action. And I torture my students with that paradox, and we work through it, and there's something about, maybe the Taoists help us a lot here, there's something about allowing your actions and intentions to unfold fluidly, the way water flows downhill. It's not passive, it's not static, it's always in motion, it's creative, it's engaged, but it's working with what is, as opposed to a kind of arbitrary, egoic imposition of some random agenda that you cooked up onto the whole of reality. So, you know, a sailboat has to get across the lake, but it doesn't do it in a straight line. It tacks back and forth. And sometimes, if you took a snapshot, it appears to be horribly off course, either going too far left or too far right. But in totality, the journey occurs from the original point to the destination. But that's not struggling. So you're right. The problem is with the terminology. I wrote a piece once called Intention versus Attachment, and it's that same kind of discussion. The Buddha talks about attaching to an outcome as being destructive. But that doesn't mean you just sit on the couch the rest of your life. You still intend to create. You intend to produce. You intend to engage. But you're always in the moment loose about which way you're going to zig and zag. And so that's the sense in which you can be very active and still not struggling. It's kind of a paradox. Surfing's a great example. You're riding a wave. You don't control the energy at all, but you decide with your intention and action to work in accord with this beautiful energy. And then great things happen, and our whole life can be seen in that way, not as a struggle, but still highly engaged.
Yeah, well put. And it, you know, which leads into let it be, you know, it, allow it to be what it is. A lot of us don't like that word, that phrase, let it be, because it sounds passive, doesn't it? It sounds
good song,
like we're,
though, yeah.
You know, good song. I remember my mother, though, when that song first came out, you know, she said, oh, I don't like that. Let it be.
Right.
That's just weakness.
Point.
That's passive. I
well,
said,
it's
Mom,
a fair point.
Yeah, but I said it's not meant that way. I think it's obviously it's not. It's to, you know, let the flow be. Let it instead of us struggling to. In fact, there's a great line in this article. I can't believe I'm saying that because I wrote it. No,
let it be.
But
Paul.
It is a good line. I can't remember writing it, but it's good. It says the practice of letting it be invites us to unclench and allow the moment to unfold free of our editorializing.
Yeah,
that's a good line.
Spot on.
Yeah, but you know, like it's exactly what you're saying. You know, unclenching. And we editorialize. We make up our minds about something when we don't need to. I think that's huge. We decide that we can't do something, you know, and then it becomes almost impossible to do it. Or we decide, well, you know, that doesn't run in my family. I'm not good at that. So, or, you know, we've never done that before. Well, you know, why not? You know, you can change. You can confound your expectations, can't you? Because you're so much more than what you tell yourself about yourself.
Well, the editorializing is a great one-word encapsulation of the whole problem of the constant judging that we do, the compartmentalization, the conceptualization. We look out at the world. We just scan left and right all day long, and we ascribe value to everything we see, and we criticize and we praise. And I like the line in the piece, the one I have underlined, is this is not a passive stance of resignation, but a spacious allowing. And what I love about Paul McCartney's song "Let It Be" is when you realize the context, he's singing about his mother Mary, who I mean on a literal level, right? Who died of breast cancer when he was a boy, and I can just imagine her saying these words on her deathbed to her young son Paul, long before the Beatles, and saying "Let it be." You know, there's this sense of, you know, life, birth, death, all these things must be accepted, embraced, celebrated, and you're not in charge. And so that's the sense in which we let it be. That doesn't mean stop intending, quite the opposite.
Interesting, isn't it, looking at the Beatles too, you know, how they ended up, you know, so different. John Lennon being, you know, murdered at 40 and George Harrison dying of complications from lung cancer, you know, 57, and then, you know, Paul and Ringo going strong into their 70s now, and it's, you know, but look at the karma of that, and also the influence. You know, it's not about your time on this planet, because John Lennon perhaps had the greatest social influence of any of the Beatles, you know, and died fairly young. I'm reading a book on Caravaggio right now, and you know, Caravaggio, one of the great painters of all time, you know, and but a crazy man, a murderer, always in trouble with the law, died at 38, you know, and yet created all these masterpieces. So it's you know, we need to relax and know whatever our dharma is, whatever our duty to this life is, just let it unfold. Do what is yours to do, and not sweat it so much, you know, just let it be. Because there is a magnificence, I believe, in all of us. We may not be a Caravaggio or a John Lennon, but we are uniquely Peter Boland and Paul Roach or whoever you are. You know, so do what is yours to do in a beautiful way. As I said in the sermon yesterday, you know, we have the resource of the universe at our disposal. The whole energy of the universe is flowing through us. Why not accept it? You know, why shortchange yourself and think that, well, I don't deserve that, or I'm not ready for that? Hey, whether you're ready or not, it's still coursing through you, you know, and you may as well celebrate it, you know, open the doors with celebration, as Isaiah said, you know, rather than open the door with trepidation. And so many of us do that and shortchange ourselves.
Yeah, you know, we should probably, maybe this is a topic for another hour, but you've brought up several great examples. Steve Jobs, Caravaggio, we're talking about Paul McCartney. John Lennon also lost his mother when he was very young. I'm thinking of Bono and The Edge, and they both lost their mothers. And there's something fascinating about childhood trauma and how it maybe drives artistic genius, great suffering. I think of Mozart and his relationship with his father. And so this is, we should do a program on creative suffering. But, you know, these were people who not only let it be, but they were also, think of Paul, I mean, incredibly ambitious. They just wanted to be the best. They did not stay home. They did not sit still. Not that we all have to go out and become global celebrities, but is there some sense in which we can model some of that incredible, boundless creation in our own lives, in our own small circles? I mean, I think it's really rich to read biographies like Caravaggio and realize that our suffering and our so-called wounds and broken places can become highly energizing batteries, so to speak, that kind of drive us out of our normal complacency. Comfort is a curse, and struggle is a kind of womb of, you know, this isn't quite done. I feel something moving through me, but then the struggle becomes in that Buddhist sense, like we're talking about today, the paradox is, or as you say, the contradiction is, this moment right now is also perfect. And we aren't trying to change reality. We simply want to allow what is moving through all of us. I don't think a tree asks itself every year, should I grow a little taller, or is that selfish of me? You know, why do we not allow what is moving through us to take flight as a way of honoring the essential energies of all things that move through all things? But there we are again, overthinking. I don't want to shine too bright, you know, and all of that.
Yeah. One of my teachers at Unity School used to refer to suffering and then useless, unnecessary suffering. You know, we all suffer. Yeah. We're in a human form. But once we buy into it and make it our story, then we're into useless, unnecessary suffering. And the Buddha referred to the two arrows, you know, the arrow of pain and then the arrow of owning your pain and suffering all of it because of it. And we don't need the second arrow. It's optional. And I think this is true in terms of our struggle, you know, that, we all have things that go on for us and we can't control those things. But they don't have to be overly important. And we don't have to, you know, I can't be successful unless I struggle. I mean, I think you know, that doesn't necessarily go together. We have this image of the poor artist, the starving artist in the garret, you know, suffering but producing this sublime music or art or whatever. Life's tough enough without us, you know, imposing more suffering on ourselves.
Right, and that's the third suggestion you make in your piece. Don't take it personally. Note to self. Remember, you don't exist. The idea of an independent, separate self, distinct from others, is one of the greatest obstacles to enjoying our true identity, as you wrote. And so
those are good lines too, aren't they?
Very good, Paul. you should feel so proud of that.
Man, I did good in this.
Not on a personal level, of course,
but not taking it personally.
But you know, listen, this is what we all do. We all are individuals, and it's absurd to try to annihilate that. In our spiritual work, I'm sometimes puzzled by the war people declare on their own selfdom, their own ego. But it's crucial that we see ourselves not as, I'm doing all this and I'm great, but we are all at play in the field of forms, and the best competitors in any field, whether it's football or painting or poetry, the best competitors have a kind of healthy ambition. I think of the wonderful teacher Wayne Dyer, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago. What a stellar career. What a towering teacher. Terribly ambitious, wonderfully ambitious, who just really, really worked hard to make the Wayne Dyer brand a thing. And the only reason we know his name is because he just was tireless in those early years when he wrote Your Erroneous Zone back in the 70s. And, you know, we say self-promotion like it's a bad thing. And yet we love the people who come into the public eye. But I think the most successful celebrity teachers, athletes, artists, whatever, are people who do it with a sense of humility and playfulness. And maybe that's where people like Steve Jobs kind of cross the line and the pathology starts to take over. They may lose a little of their humanity. We see this risk in all public figures who have power who play a role and who then believe that they are that role. And that's when it kind of goes awry. So don't take it personally is a huge piece of this.
Right. And in a way, that's Steve Jobs' own personal tragedy, you know, that he was a genius in some areas, but then, you know, very crippled in other areas of his life, the lack of empathy or whatever. I think that maybe that was why there was such an outpouring of grief when he passed, you know, because he created this this tool for all of us to bring us all together. And yet we also noticed that there was something, you know, hollow in it, something missing. And that dichotomy was tough to deal with. I don't know. But yeah, you know, there's nothing wrong with your ego here. You know, it just is not what you think it is. That's the key. Right. I mean, I think it's fine to have a healthy ego to help you navigate around. Just as you have a body, you have a sense of self, but it's literally that sense of self. It's not a thing in and of itself, and that's where it all goes south. Is when we begin to think that, you know, I am me. You know, it's my body mind vehicle, and you know, then we worry about it. It's going to be destroyed at death. You know, what's going to happen to me? You know, personally, I'm fine with that. You know, I'll move on to another body mind if I do. And if I don't, I'll become one with the indifferentiated essence, which is the reality of me anyway. So it's all safe, you know. And to tell you the truth, you know, one lifetime of being you is more than enough, I think, you know. It's like I want to try being somebody else the next time. I mean, I like Paul, but, you know, I'm not attached to the guy, you know. It's like, you know, he's got too many weirdnesses. So let's have somebody else. I mean, you see what I'm saying? It's we got to laugh about ourselves a little bit and not be too attached to it. Certainly don't take it personally.
Right. Well,
and all the great masters, I was going to say, all the great masters, it seems, you know, have a light laughing joy about that, don't they? They just don't take themselves too seriously, and when they see other people doing just that, they kind of find it amusing.
Right, and humor is a part of humility, and I think of the ego as just another tool in the toolbox, like my hands. I use my hands all the time. They're crucial, but I am not my hands. And that's you know, jumping to your seventh point, contact the witness, what Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita calls the inner witness. My ego is an essential tool, like my hands, but my hands cannot exist in isolation. They are only an aspect of an entire interconnected organism. So too, my ego has no independent reality. It can't exist apart from my body, but it also can't exist apart from the cosmos and the interconnectedness of all being. So a wave on the surface of the ocean has, you can't chop it off, take it home, put it in a box. It has no reality apart from the ocean. So too the ego, we can speak about it as if it were a thing, but it is in no way an individual separate thing. And that's
right.
The key part of this. It's
right, unless the built-in conundrum of being apparently separate, isn't it? We seem to be separate beings physically, and we're wandering around the planet and everything. And we forget that we're actually intimately connected to it, that we wouldn't exist without it for one second. And coming back to that recognition is important. Okay, here's the music again, folks, which means we're at the end of our second segment. I'm with Peter Boland talking about how to stay awake. We're having some fun here. We'll be back by talking about deciding to enjoy, what that means. So join us after these messages from Unity.
Is there a difference between the spiritual teachings you know and how you live your life? Does your day-to-day experience reflect what you truly value? Are you ready to receive your life and live the gift that you are? Join Janice Campbell, licensed Unity teacher, author, and coach, each week as she shares inspiration and tools to help you identify and dissolve the limiting beliefs that prevent you from living the fullest expression of what you are. Talk with Janice live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Central on Receive Your Life, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. We're talking about staying awake, and I'm with Peter Boland coming out of San Diego. He's a singer-songwriter. He's a professor at a local college there. He writes for Unity Magazine and other organs, and blogs regularly, and always has insightful things to say, spiritually, politically, socially, and every other way. So it's always a fun time to have Peter on the show. Email me if you have a question or some comments. I'd love to have a dialogue. PaulJohnRoach@yahoo.com. Just send me something in email. That'd be great. Decide to enjoy. You know, so often we put off our good till a later time, until everything's perfect. We go on a vacation, we expect it to be perfect. We're looking for the most perfect landscape, the most perfect meal, the most perfect place to be intimate with each other, whatever it might be. And in fact, the most memorable times can be standing in line and we meet somebody, or we have an awkward moment, but it turns into something funny, whatever. It's not those planned times where we plan to enjoy things. We decide to enjoy the ordinary moments, just like that suburban scene. I didn't decide that it was going to happen, but I decided, presumably in my mind, to be open and receptive to something, and then it showed up. So I think it's an attitude of mind, isn't it, to decide that today will be a day of opportunity and adventure, as I write, and because of the powerful law of attraction and reciprocity, it will become exactly that.
And this is a tricky one, because yes, it is a decision, but it is perhaps more a decision to become available for it.
Yeah,
it's not a switch. It's not a switch you can throw and then suddenly you're all happy and giddy. That might be misleading, but it is absolutely a decision to allow a range of perceptions and emotions instead of doggedly sticking to your sadness or whatever. I'm struck by a quote from Abraham Lincoln that I have never been able to trace down, so it's probably a false quote. But
okay.
Many of his biographers claim that he was, by our definition, depressive, quite depressive. And he said in one quote I saw, happiness is a decision. And it's that same kind of idea. And that's a remarkable thing to say for someone who is clinically depressed and they didn't know much, you know, or as they called it in the 19th century, melancholia. Sounds a little sexier. But there is still, even under biochemical sadness, even in the face of real grief and absolute tragedy, we are the authors of our own consciousness. Viktor Frankl, of course, in his classic Man's Search for Meaning, is so crucial on this point that even in Auschwitz, he noticed that men who chose to have hope, to impose meaning on a meaningless, horrific absurdity, survived. and those who collapsed and gave in to the nihilistic despair that their conditions obviously led to did not survive. And so we do have more freedom in our consciousness than we think. And what if you and I, in our relatively comfortable middle-class lives, so many of us, still had much more power than we thought to direct our consciousness in chosen directions? It's a powerful
yes.
teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the core of my article, though, is the next one, and that's be quiet, you know, because everything before is leading us in that direction, not to take it
yep.
personally, stop struggling, let it be. It's the idea of then dropping down into the stillness, which if there was only one way to stay awake, then this would be the one, you know, just simply be quiet. The Bible talks about it over and over. Jesus talks about it. And I like what Papaji, or H.W.L. Poonjaji, as he was called, said, you know, just be quiet when he was asked the secrets of enlightenment. And you know, he was not a very nice man in some ways. He was a rigorous teacher. And he could have been saying it, you know, just shut up. But I think he was also pointing to an inner truth, too. Just be quiet. That's the key, isn't it? Is what we're doing when we're quiet is opening up space to realize, as we said earlier, who we already are. And that's the point of any spiritual practice, I think, is just to create spaciousness so that the natural truth will arise, you know, effortlessly, if you like, naturally, in a very ordinary way. And as Srinagasiddhanta wrote, he says, in the light of calm and steady self-awareness, inner energies wake up and work miracles without any effort on your part. Lovely stuff.
Lovely stuff. And that's the key. The reason quietness or stillness is so important is because it brings us for a moment out of that outward turned conceptual mind with all of its complexes, judgments, and assessments that we were speaking about before. And most of us tend to live our life that way. And so in the meditation practice, in contemplative practice, the stillness is so deceptively effective because of the reason you cited. When we grow still, finally, that soft inner awareness, that inner light begins to become visible, begins to become heard. It's normally drowned out by the glare and the noise of the outward world that we focus on so carefully, what the Vedanta tradition calls Maya. And so when we become still in meditation and in contemplation, we go inside. And so like Nisargadatta says, a quiet mind is all you need. All else will happen rightly once your mind is quiet. So that's the sense, like your first point, don't struggle. There is no seeking in spiritual work. We're not trying to go anywhere. There's not some big literal journey to take if you are already that, and the method par excellence is quiet and stillness.
Right, and then you know after that comes the commitment, you know, to put it into action.
Yeah.
Because we talked about this yesterday in the service. You know, we were talking about joy and Ananda and bliss, and the idea that once you're inspired, once that joy is bubbling within you, then you have to put it into practice. It may bring you more buoyancy, which then leads to generosity, but that must be put into action as compassion. And unless you do that, I think it's going to fizzle out. So we have to have ways in which we can commit that energy that arises from awakening to be of service in our world. I think that's crucial. I'm not talking about being a do-gooder, you know. The Pope yeah. recently said he didn't like do-gooders because this is sort of a top-down thing.
Right.
This service in the world is being wherever you are in a helpful way. Whatever it is yours to do it with you know that awareness of we're all in this together. How can I be helpful? I love that idea. I think it's crucial to maintaining an awakened state, you know, to find ways we can bring it into our everyday life.
Yes, and so many teachers, I'm thinking right off the top of my head of Marianne Williamson and scores of others, have made this point that your single greatest contribution to world peace is your spiritual awakening. And when one awakened person shows up, the whole room shifts. And so that's the commitment we're talking about. As you say in your piece, we're not committitting to a specific outcome. We're committing to the cultivation of character and becoming right. What we really are. We're not outward turned again in the machinations of whatever it is we're doing, our social justice work, our political work, our entrepreneurial work, teaching a puppy how to be a good dog, whatever it is you're engaged in. Yes, you have the end in mind, but there's a light hand on the reins and a firm commitment to everybody's best outcome. And you don't have anything specific in mind about what that ideal outcome is, except that it is the best outcome. And then your actions naturally move into accord with what is already unfolding around you. And this seems to be the most effective path of what, as Krishna in the Gita calls, action without attachment to the fruits of action.
Right, you know, choiceless awareness. The many traditions talk about it, actionless activity. You know, it's where we give up the expectation and are simply doing things naturally. It's quite a powerful state. Again, you know, great sports people know about it because, you know, they're effortless. When we ride a bike, we know about it because we're not thinking about how we ride that bike. We're just on it and we start gliding down the street, and it's a wonderful thing. But, you know, it took us a while when we were kids to learn how to do that, how to have that balance and trust and grace, really, to float down the street on that, those little wheels there. Not much touches the ground. And,
right.
You know, in all this, though, you know, this is my final point. In everything, you know, contact the witness. Always be aware of that inner witness or observer self within yourself. Because once you're in touch with that, once you understand that, once you let the universe breathe through you, if you like, because that's the witness, then it becomes a playful thing. You're no longer obsessed with yourself or with how you look or how you show it up. You know, you are okay. And it's very relaxing. You can walk into any room and feel confident. Because, you know, your ego's not on the line. You're bringing the witness, and you're noticing that same beautiful presence within everyone, so we're all one. It's a very relaxing state, I think, and it gives us a authenticity and power that's palpable.
And that's why there's no struggle, back to your first point. The struggle
right.
falls away when you simply show up in the consciousness of the inner witness, just so glad that you get to be you today, and so wonderful the way all the support systems have brought you to this moment, and that you do have a little something to offer, and there are those willing to receive it. That's all you need. So that's a powerful part, and the more that we practice this, the more convinced we become, and we're the only ones that need the convincing. You know, we're not doing missionary work here. This is inner work. This is an inside job, and then ideally our gradual awakening has a powerful, attractive influence on certain people around us who want what we want. We all came up that, like that as dumb kids, and we met men and women along the way, and we said, I want what she has. I want what he has. They had that certain presence. And as we all grow into our middle and older ages, you know, we trust there's all these beautiful young people coming up behind us, and it's a sacred tradition, this passing on.
Absolutely.
Unintentionally. Yeah,
absolutely.
Great.
Folks, we're at the end of the show. We could talk for a few more hours, and we will. Peter will be back on the show somewhere down the line. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye. Next week, Gordon Asher Davidson joins me. He's going to talk about his book. It's called The Transfiguration of the World, How a Light Alliance is Transforming Darkness and Creating a New Earth. And I say, bring it on. Yeah. Okay, so we'll find out what he's talking about, the transfiguration of the world. But right now, I want to thank Peter for, once again, a delightful show. So thank you, Peter.
Thank you. PeterBoland.com if you want to find me online.
PeterBoland.com. Check him out. He's a busy man. He's doing all kinds of things. he covers the waterfront, folks. And again, thanks for listening. And join us again next week on World Spirituality. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
There is peace.
Reverend Paulette's mantra is, "It's all a prayer." Tune in every Tuesday as Unity Minister Paulette Pipe leads you in meditation and prayer on Touching the Stillness. Make no mistake, this is not nap time. With an energy that will captivate you, Touching the Stillness will guide you in deep meditation, leaving you enlivened. Hear astounding meditations and learn more about different forms of meditation. Enrich your prayer life as Reverend Paulette, Senior Minister of Touching the Stillness Ministries, affirmatively prays with power and authority by taking live prayer requests from callers like you. Whether you have a prayer request for yourself or for a loved one or are ready for a deepened meditation experience, make sure you tune in on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Central Time, where we'll be joining in consciousness with the unceasing prayer activity of the Silent Unity 24/7 Prayer Ministry at Unity Village. That's Touching the Stillness with Reverend Paulette Pipe every Tuesday right here on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Letting go in the stillness.
Inspiration only takes a moment. As Reverend Felicia Blanco Circe points out in her book, Do Greater Things, there is the potential for joy, wholeness and expansiveness designed into every moment. And the miracle is when we recognize the constant presence of these qualities all around us. Once we see what is possible, our lives then begin to change.
This meditative moment is brought to you by Unity.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.